Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, this is Rear Vision and I'm Annabelle Quince. In this week's program, a look at the history of the Palestinian refugees of Lebanon.
And staying overseas in Lebanon, there are concerns that this week's violence between government troops and Palestinian militants from a refugee camp in the north of the country could spread.
The militants have taken refuge in the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp, home to between 30 and 40,000 Palestinians.
The Lebanese cabinet ordered the army to step up its attacks, but it's a delicate time for the Lebanese government. It has to be careful not to provoke a backlash from tens of thousands of other Palestinians living in squalid refugee camps around the country.
The Lebanese army is not storming the Nahr el-Bared camp, but the Lebanese army is defending itself against snipers and mortars and the people, elements of Fatah al-Islam that have killed up to now more than 30 soldiers.
Over the past 2 weeks, Lebanese soldiers have battled militia from the Fatah al-Islam group in the Palestinian refugee camp of Nahr el-Bared. While speculation rages about where the militants come from and who backs them, innocent Palestinian refugees are being caught in the crossfire. But as we will hear in today's program, being caught in the crossfire is nothing new for the Palestinians of Lebanon. According to the United Nations, there are over 390,000 Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. That's almost 10% of the Lebanese population. Their story begins for us today on the 29th of November 1947, when the United Nations General Assembly passed Resolution 181, which attempted to divide the British Mandate of Palestine between the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
The result of the vote sent both Jews and Arabs through the streets of Jerusalem, the Jews dancing in joy and the Arabs rioting in anger. Britain told the UN it would terminate the mandate within 6 months. The military withdrawal began immediately. British responsibility ended on May the 15th, 1948, with the departure of the High Commissioner. On the same day, amid scenes of great emotion, David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the independent state of Israel.
Veteran Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk lives in Lebanon and is the author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East.
In 1948, when the State of Israel was founded, 750,000 Palestinians fled or were thrown out of their homes in what was Palestine, what is now Israel. Those to the south went to Gaza. Those around Jerusalem went to East Jerusalem or to the West Bank, as we now call it. And those to the north in Galilee went to Lebanon. Most of the Palestinians here are the sons, grandsons, or actual Palestinians who fled the northern part of Palestine that was called Galilee. And these are the people who are now in Nahr el-Bared, in Badawi, in Sabra, Shatila, Burj al-Barajni, Rashidiyah, and the other big Palestinian camps in Lebanon. So the Palestinians in Lebanon are the children or the grandchildren of those who fled Palestine, northern Palestine, in 1948.
Al-Fat Mahmoud is the director of the Women's Humanitarian Organization in Lebanon. Her parents and grandparents were among those Palestinians who fled Lebanon in 1948.
It's my parents' and grandparents' experience because I was born in Lebanon. This is after 1948 war and the creation of the State of Israel. Lebanon was very close to the village where I come from. So they decided to go toward the south of Lebanon. And this is how it started. It's just women taking their children to a safe place. And they were promised it will be only for a short period, about 2 weeks. So they left their homes, hoping that after 2 weeks, things will be settled and they will be able to return back. And now it's 59 years.
And what was life like in those first years when your grandparents came over?
Yeah, they tell us really like the story of all refugees. First of all, they came in with fear. they left Palestine walking to Lebanon. My aunt, she said, I still remember, she was about 5 years of old. Her feet were full of blisters because of the walking. And her other sister, who is only 2 years older than her, had to carry her most of the time because of the pain she had. And my grandmother lost three of her children. One of them died from measles, then the other one pneumonia, and the other one, she said, he just died, she doesn't know. But they were all, like, young. And, of course, they had their own lands, they were farmers, they had their own fields. They came to Lebanon and they had nothing. They suffered a lot, they lived in tents for many years. Until the last minute, my grandmother used to say, why I should live in a camp in a very small, tiny house with no facilities, while in Palestine I own huge land.
Under resolution, under a UN resolution 191, which was a General Assembly resolution, therefore non-binding, the idea was that the Palestinians would return to their homes once the conflict was over. You know, many Palestinians, they'll tell you still who were alive then, who remember then, they came to Lebanon here, and they believed they were going home in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Once the fighting was over, once the war was over, whoever won, they would go back to their homes. That's what the UN resolution said. But of course, when the war was over and the Israelis had won, the Israelis did not wish them to return to their homes. And they never went back. In the end, they all ended up in the camps. Some of them, very few, got Lebanese nationality or Jordanian nationality. And most of them remained just displaced persons.
I was born in 1960, so I still remember the life in the 60s in the camps. I didn't live in tents, but my parents did for a few years. I was born in a house. It's the second house after the tent. When they replaced the tents, they replaced it with mud houses, and the roof was metal roof with big holes. I remember, as a child, we never had really a full night's sleep because in winter, when it rained, of course, the water will come through these big holes. So our parents will put buckets on the roof, and always they have to empty it when it's full. So we always, as a children, had to wake up at the middle of the night because our parents will put these buckets or empty them. We never had space. The houses were really jammed, like the house next to the other house. I never felt that we have privacy. Privacy means nothing for us. As a child, I always felt there is something missing. Why? Why people, like, I felt people were not happy. And, of course, when I grew up, I understand why was that feeling. But it's not a nice feeling at all. Also, as Palestinians, always the police were around the camp. And the police were keeping an eye on the camp. Outside the houses was sand and open sewages, with no facilities inside the camp. We didn't have water at all. Women will collect water by hand. We didn't have electricity. Life was not easy at all, at all.
Once you ask a person to abandon their country and become the citizen of another country, you're asking them to abandon their life and their hopes and the land that they own. So that's the first issue. The second point, of course, is that, and this is the hard grind of reality, is that most Palestinians are Sunni Muslims. Once you make them citizens of a country called Syria or Lebanon or wherever, they're going to change the map of religious ownership. If you make 750,000 or even 360,000, which is generally given the figure for Palestinians in Lebanon now, once you make them Sunni Muslims, you increase enormously the figure of the Sunni Muslim population of this country. And you make them almost, if not more, powerful than the Shia Muslims. So you set off this sectarian game where you start saying, well, you know, the Sunni Muslims were X percentage of the population, but now they're Y because we've made all these Palestinians into Lebanese. And then the Christians say, well, hold on a second, that makes them bigger than us, right? So you've created countries. We created these countries, remember, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, after the First World War. We created these countries, Britain and France, the victors of the First World War. And now we're going to say, oh, well, let's make all the Palestinians citizens of these countries. You're going to radically transform and change the sectarian makeup of the countries involved.
You're with me, Annabelle Quince, on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web, and this is Rear Vision. In today's program, we're looking back at the history of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. When the PLO were evicted from Jordan in 1970, they began to move into the camps of Lebanon.
When PLO came to Lebanon in the late 60s, early 70s, people looked at it at the beginning as a message from God, you know. It's like they came to save their lives, to take them back to their homeland, all of these things. And, of course, when they came here, they wanted to show the people their support and responsibility. So, yes, they changed their life a little bit. They brought some electricity to the camp. We had the water for washing and washing up for using, like, from underground. They replaced their mud houses into a little bit better houses. Unfortunately, PLO at that period in Europe was very well known only with its military body, but as a matter of fact, they had all departments. They had, in addition to the military, they had the educational department, social department, health department, we had hospitals, we had clinics. Students were given scholarships to continue their education, social welfare also, people were supported, widows, orphans, all these services. Also, UNRWA, the United Nations Agency, they had schools for refugee children, only for the first 10 years of education. And PLO used to give the student scholarship to finish their high school and university.
No, the PLO never really improved the living conditions in the camps. That's a myth. UNRWA, which is the UN organization which deals with Palestinians, they have always looked after the refugees. And they've had enough money to give them schooling. And they've had enough money just about to bring them enough food, basic food, you know. So they've never starved, except when they've been under siege or in war. I think that the PLO brought them a political objective, the idea of there being a Palestine that they could go back to, which never actually happened. As we know, the PLO was not able to produce a Palestine. Arafat always said, you will go home, you'll have the right to return, you'll go back to your homes in Palestine. And the poor Palestinians here believed Arafat. They believed they were going to go eventually back to their homes in Galilee. And they were not. And Arafat must have known that. And only when the PLO was driven out of Beirut to Tunisia by the Israelis in 1983-84, only when Arafat went back to Gaza and the West Bank, but not to Palestine, only then did they begin to realize that Arafat had no intention of returning them to their homes. They couldn't go back. They would never go back.
Political tension had always been a part of Lebanese politics, but in 1975, those tensions boiled over, and the Lebanese civil war began.
The commercial centre of Beirut has seen some of the worst fighting, and there doesn't seem to be a single building undamaged. A week ago, I was walking past shops and offices and banks. Today, in the same street, I scuttled and ran among piles of rubble and coal-black burnt-out buildings. There have been more meetings today between the cabinet, the Syrian foreign minister, who's mediating to end the fighting, left and right-wing Lebanese politicians, and the Palestinian guerrilla leader, Yasser Arafat.
As Palestinians, we took part in the civil war, but we are not the cause, and this is what should be clear for everybody. The civil war started after the assassination of one of the MBs in Sidon, in Saida. And after that, the country went into a mess. And of course, Palestinians, because they were not welcomed by the right-wing parties, and the civil war started between the left-wing parties and the right-wing parties, the PLO supported the left-wing. And at the same time, the right-wing parties, they fought PLO and they fought the Palestinians before, but no one mentioned this. In 1970, in 1972, 73, the camps were hit by the Lebanese government, like from the plains, and no one mentioned this. They only remember the civil war and the Palestinians were part of this, or the cause even. They don't say they were part of this. But as a matter of fact, we had many clashes before the civil war in Lebanon. And if you read the Lebanese history, every few years, always there was a civil war. And in 1841, there was a civil war, and we were not there. In 1860, there was a civil war, and we were not there.
Arafat, who was the leader of the PLO, did not want the Palestinians to be involved in the Lebanese Civil War. The Lebanese Civil War was between the Christians and the rest, Christians and Muslims, if you like. And Arafat did not want to get embroiled in this. He believed that the moment that the Palestinians became entangled in this war, their cause would be lost. And he was right, but he failed. Because at the end of the day, the Muslim side in the Civil War was leftist. And the Christian side was supported by Israel. And it became natural for the Palestinians to want to support the Muslim side. Most of the fighters were Sunni Muslim in Lebanon. And the Palestinians were Sunni Muslim. And leaders, political leaders like the socialist Druze leader, Kemal Jumblatt, naturally had a huge following among the Palestinians. So politically, they followed the Muslims, and they became involved in the civil war. And ultimately, they became anti-Christian, pro-Muslim forces, which was a terrible, terrible political mistake, as well as being a tragic human mistake for both the Christians and the Muslims. But they did become involved. And in the end, the PLO and the Muslims of Lebanon became part of the civil war. Thousands and thousands of Palestinians were killed, executed, murdered, and did commit murder. And the two big Palestinian camps in the east of Beirut, which were in a Christian area, both camps were surrounded and annihilated, and the people, virtually all the Palestinians, were liquidated. They were murdered. They were lined up against walls and shot dead. But, you know, could the Palestinians have avoided being involved in that civil war? I doubt it.
Throughout the 1970s, the PLO had attacked Israel from Lebanon. In 1982, in the midst of the Lebanese civil war, Israel invaded Lebanon, occupied Beirut, and forced the PLO to leave.
Israel has launched a major sea, air, and land attack into southern Lebanon. Its prime purpose, according to government sources in Tel Aviv, is to drive PLO guerrillas away from Israeli borders.
In 1982, when the Israel invaded Lebanon and there was agreements which was made and PLO left Lebanon, as Palestinian people living in Lebanon, we lost all the support we used to get from PLO, like our hospitals, the scholarships, the social welfare program. All of this was collapsed. So the impact was very, very, very negative, and people lived with absolutely very limited services.
After the PLO left Lebanon, the Palestinian camps were vulnerable to both the Shiite militia and the Lebanese right-wing militia. In September 1982, the Sabra and Shatila camps were attacked.
We begin this week with the Middle East and condemnation around the world of the massacre of hundreds of Palestinian refugees in a camp in West Beirut over the weekend. In Beirut, the work of removing the bodies of men, women and children is still going on. The killers were apparently Lebanese Christian militia forces, and there are strong suggestions that Israeli troops who control that part of West Beirut stood by and did nothing to stop the massacre.
Sabra and Shatila massacres took place with no reason. We don't know why. Myself, I don't like to remember it because I was in the middle of it. I was in the hospital where they attacked that hospital and many doctors and nurses were killed and people. So it's just to make the Palestinians' life more difficult. And again, maybe this they will put all the pressure to make us feel powerless and accept any solution.
In 1983, the Israelis withdrew to the southern part of Lebanon, where they remained until 2000. In 1991, the Lebanese civil war finally came to an end.
Well, they became safer in the sense that once the civil war had wound down, they were no longer under attack by the Shiites or the Sunnis or the Christians or the West. To that extent, they lived longer. But lived in what? In squalor. They continue to live in the camps. There are very strict rules in Lebanon, stricter than there are in any other Arab countries, over what Palestinians can and cannot do. They can't have jobs here. They can't be doctors. They can't be educated. They can't go to university. They're not allowed to. In other words, they are condemned to being the third-class citizens in an Arab country. So these people lived safer lives, but they lived in squalor.
The sound of intense automatic gunfire and exploding artillery shells could be heard from several kilometers away as renewed fighting erupted around the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp near Tripoli.
A lull in fighting has allowed thousands of Palestinian refugees to flee their camp in northern Lebanon.
All the while, the militant Fatah al-Islam group remained holed up in the camp. The Lebanese cabinet ordered the army to step up its attacks, but it's a delicate time for the Lebanese government. It has to be careful not to provoke a backlash from tens of thousands of other Palestinians living in squalid refugee camps around the country.
All of you heard about what's called Fatah al-Islam, which it's very new for us also. And unfortunately, I don't know why they stick it to the Palestinians. It's not a Palestinian body at all, at all. Also, they are multinationality. It's like we have people from Lebanon, Palestinian, Syrian, Algerian, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Sudanese, different nationalities. This is when we asked people, how did they come to the camp? Why? They said, like, they came to the camp as Arabs. They came to support Palestinian people. And people did not question who they are or what they want because they met their needs. And at the end, they turn up. They are there to create a problem. But it was too late when they discovered this.
This whole recent crisis involving the Palestinians in the north of Lebanon, the whole drama of the Palestinians in Nahr al-Bared, they're being used. There is this group called the Fatah al-Islam, which is obviously funded by other countries, Syria, Iran, who knows. And there are only about 300 or 400 members, but they're living in a Palestinian camp, and the army are besieging them in northern Lebanon. And they attacked the Lebanese army and murdered many of them. Four of them they chopped off their heads. The Palestinians in this camp who live there are the grandchildren and great-grandchildren and children and, in some cases, the actual original survivors of 1948. And they are being used. There's no doubt about it. But because they're being bombarded and shelled by the Lebanese army, now they feel that they are one with the extremists. They believe that they're now being held to account and made to pay physically in terms of their own lives for the crimes of a few people. This has always been the Palestinians' sin.
So after 59 years in the camps, what future is there for the Palestinian refugees of Lebanon?
There is no future for the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. They're not going to go home. They can't go back to that part of Palestine because they came from, because that is now the state of Israel. They will stay here and rot. At some point, perhaps, they may become Lebanese citizens in the far future when sectarianism no longer matters. But you see, sectarianism does matter. I was asked the other day by a woman who is a correspondent for Al Hayat, which is a Saudi-backed newspaper, international Arab newspaper, you know, what can be done with Lebanon? I said, well, you know, I said, the problem is that it can never be a modern state. Because where you have a state, which you do in Lebanon, where the president has got to be a Christian Maronite, where the prime minister has got to be a Sunni Muslim, where the speaker of parliament has got to be a Shiite Muslim, you can never have a modern state. You've got to get rid of sectarianism. And we set this down. This is the system we created. We Westerners, the French, in fact, in this case. So what is the future of Lebanon? I think eternal crisis. Eternal crisis. What is the future of the Palestinians? No hope. I took a good friend of mine, a Canadian, dear Canadian friend of mine, down around Sabra Shatila camp, 7 years ago. And we were walking around, and there were rats as big as footballs jumping over the garbage tip. And I turned to her and I said, you know, if I lived here, I'd commit suicide. And she turned to me quick as a flash. She was a Muslim girl. And she said, you've just given me the reason why there are suicide bombers. And I said, yes, of course I have.
Today's sound engineer was Stephen Tilley, and archive material came from ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and you've been listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your company.
You've
been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.